Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly in our brand new Saturday night home. Of course, you won't know anything about that if you've been listening to the podcast, and there's absolutely no shame in that. This time, we'll be hearing from some of our old favourites, with Maurice Gohan on The Sopranos and Paddy Woodworth adding a book by Michael Viney to the Naturalist bookshelf. Also this weekly, a musical collaboration involving monkeys and a mezzo-soprano. But we begin with the conductor, David Brophy, on what a COVID-era orchestra looks like. This week, the RTE National Symphony Orchestra returned to the stage of the National Concert Hall for its new season, a season, let's say it one more time, unlike any other. This new season will feature concerts from an empty auditorium, with the audience at home on their TVs or laptops, or indeed their phones. First up on the podium on Friday was Ireland's favourite reality TV choirmaster, David Brophy. Culturefile sent the conductor a Zoom invite for a chat, and I began by asking him about what the pandemic has meant for someone whose art is all about getting people to work closely together.
Of course, we all feel a lot more separated and less connected, or whatever that is, in the pandemic. But I think prior to the pandemic, I think, you know, on a kind of a political level, I think we've been moving far apart from each other for a long time, actually, for many, many years now. And I know we use the term populism in politics a lot. And when you think of what's going on in the US as we lead into the election in, whatever, 8 weeks' time or 9 weeks' time, and you think of what's going on in various parts of the world and how, you know, populist governments have dealt with the pandemic, we're less and less able to listen, actually, to each other. And we're less and less able to hear somebody else's point of view and actually just hear it. Not react, don't say yes or no, don't like, dislike the thumbs up and the thumbs down we have at the end of every screen. And our communication as a result has become a lot more primitive, I think. I think it's a lot more binary. Yes, no, black, white, zero, ones. That's what our communication has turned into now. And the problems we're dealing with in the world, including the pandemic, are actually very nuanced. I think the people like me, maybe you say bringing people together, I don't mean that just in the physical way, which is maybe how you meant the question, but actually in terms of psychologically, mentally, emotionally, politically, we need to bring ourselves together a lot more. If we don't start cooperating, this planet's in trouble. And not just on the local, but on the macro level as well, on the global level. And so, if you know, it's not just me, but there's lots of people trying to do that. But maybe that's why people like me who bring people together are possibly more important nowadays. Although I coil at thinking that we're saying I'm more important. It's dreadful. That's a real conductor's thing to say.
Well, how about useful?
Yeah, useful maybe, you know, but I think we all have those powers, though. You know, I mean, everybody has a family. We've all got to do these things. We've all got to bring ourselves together. And it means listening is important. More important than ever nowadays, listening is important. And then how we react to what we're hearing around us is also very important. So listening and comprehension, they're all important things. And music is a great way of learning how to listen, I believe.
So what's been happening to you as a conductor over this period? First off, there must be no work, and then there must be a very strange type of work.
Yeah, I mean, it's what's been happening. I've been having a slow nervous breakdown, Luke, for the past 5 months is what I've been having, a crisis of all sorts. Like, we all have been having a slow nervous breakdown for the past few months. Initially, because I run around doing lots of different things all the time, it was great just to stop moving and to sit down and actually had time to think. And sometimes we're all guilty of running around a lot and not having time to think. So it stopped for a while, and then I got very worried. I'm saying, is the phone ever going to ring again? How long does the pandemic go on for? The same as everybody else in my situation, particularly people who are musicians or work in the arts, and are particularly those who are freelance and have no jobs. Then the phone did kind of ring, and I ended up getting recording sessions in Vienna, of all places. That was for a film score for the new Riverdance animated film that's coming out sometime soon, which we were due to do with the RTE Concert Orchestra in Dublin, but there was no orchestras happening in April, May, June, so we had to go elsewhere to get it done. And Vienna and Austria had opened up. They'd started opening up by the end of April, I think April 26th, So by the time we got to May and June, that was one of our options. So we had to get that done. So I did go to Vienna for 3 days and record.
Were you following the science very carefully? Because, I mean, there was a load of specific science about what singers were doing and what woodwind was doing. And it was all quite confusing for somebody who didn't even have to organise the orchestra.
I did follow the science, like a lot of people. I looked at the studies. There was one particular study in the UK where they got singers and instrumentalists, they got a flautist to come in and sing into, I don't know what you'd call it, it looked like a plunger you'd kind of clear your sync with, you know, and they were going to see how far droplets would travel when you were singing. Apparently the latest research is that singing, for some reason, is not as dangerous, even though we had stories at the very beginning of lockdown of, you know, obviously the famous choir in Washington, and there was a choral concert that happened in Amsterdam where huge amounts of people in the choirs got infected very early on. It looks like now that singing may not be as dangerous as you would think it is. Then I thought about, well, it depends on the conductor. I mean, if you've got a conductor who's looking for very hard clipped consonants, especially explosive consonants like D's and T's and B's. Well, obviously, if you're going to, you know, be in a choir where you're going to have very hard T's and very hard D's, that's going to create a lot more saliva coming out of your mouth, a lot more droplets going forward than a conductor who's very happy for you to sing on vowels all the time. So, you know, I haven't conducted a choir since lockdown. So maybe when I get back, I'll be encouraging all my choirs to not so be so percussive with their consonants and just sing on the vowels all the time.
One of the things that is sort of changed is you're not going to imagine flying in an international soloist. You're going to look to the talent pool in Ireland, which must be great for people who would like to have soloist opportunities.
Like, I was in front of a fantastic orchestra in Vienna, which was a freelance band with members from four different orchestras, the ORF Radio Symphony Orchestra, the Vienna Symphony Orchestra, the Vienna Philharmonic, and the Staatsoper, were all the players in front of me. But I mean, I still did the same things I would do with the National Symphony Orchestra and the RT Concert Orchestra here. There's not, to be frank, like strictly between us, Luke, there's not a huge difference. There really isn't. And when you go and play and work with different orchestras, I've worked with orchestras in America, in Europe, in South America, in Asia, I've worked with orchestras. You still deal with the same things. You're still dealing with, you know, ensemble, pitch, expression, phrasing, all the various different things, no matter where you go. You know, because music is such an international field now, that also applies to standards. There's an international standard now you find in orchestral playing that may not have been there before the age of travel, mass travel, 50, 60, 70 years ago, even maybe 30 years ago. You look at now how we're all teaching online now. So there's been a rise of masterclasses online. So people now can get masterclasses with Itzhak Perlman, you know. So the notion of, you know, regional differences in terms of both soloistic and conducting talent, but also in terms of orchestral talent, that's becoming less and less prevalent. We have a more homogenous world in terms of what the standards are like across the world. And I think that can be seen when I travel. I said, you know, the people in Dublin are just as good as the people in Vienna, and they are just as good as the people in America. You know, they really are. And that, you know, if it makes us reassess what we have on our doorstep, maybe appreciate the talent we have on our doorstep as a result of all this, that won't be a bad thing. The process for this new season in the concert hall is going to be completely different, obviously. I don't know what I'm going to get because I haven't rehearsed with the orchestra yet, but I'm going to get 34 players, I've been told, that are all going to be separated by 2 meters. We will obviously be performing in front of an empty national concert hall, which in itself would be strange. I don't know. There's a bit of a leap of faith. I don't know how I'm going to feel to give a performance in front of an empty hall or in front of no audience.
Well, I wonder, are they're going to do like they do in the football and introduce a kind of cough track? Spasmodic spluttering.
I'm glad you mentioned it because I actually looked at a bit of football a few weeks ago and I'm going, there's no one in that stadium. Like, is that happening in the stadium or do they put it in for the television audience? Like, is that happen? Is that overdubbed afterwards? You know, I am glad you mentioned it because I've been really curious about like this canned, like, you know, football crowd sound. Yeah, I don't know whether I'm in favour of canned coughing or canned clapping, but I do like the notion that at the end we all clap for ourselves a little bit. Everyone taps the stands and that's been going on. I've seen stuff on the BBC Proms over the past week or so where, you know, people clap for each other and that, you know, and that's been kind of nice, you know. So I presume, you know, well, I will certainly clap for the National Symphony Orchestra. There's no doubt about it. And I maybe they might, you know, show some appreciation for all of what we've done.
David Brophy there, and that opening concert of the RTE NSO's new season is now available to listen back on the Lyrics site. Now, the art of Karen Power involves getting her ears and her microphones around the globe, collecting the sounds of Arctic ice and snow, birds and monkeys of the Amazon jungle, or the geckos of the Australian desert. But the new regime meant a bit of a rethink for composers like her. Travel restrictions meant that Power had time to dive deep into the sounds she'd already gathered in nearly a decade of voyages. From her golden hoard, Power selected 18 recordings and invited musicians from around the world to work with the sounds. And the results can be heard on her latest album, Human Nature. Culturefile's Rachel Andrews spoke to Power and one of her musical collaborators, Laurie Lixenberg, about nature's music, new ways of composing, and the possibilities for making art in a changed world.
I guess it came out of both a personal need and a sort of strand of a body of work. Once lockdown happened, obviously we all went through a lot of different emotions, and I, like many creatives, felt that I couldn't do anything. And so I thought, okay, let's go extreme. Let's go the other end of the creative spectrum. And I began to think about these sort of micro moments that we all share. And we can all share privately. My name is Karen Power. For a long time, I'd been thinking about this sort of body of field recordings that I have and I only ever get to use for very specific reasons. So this CD allowed me to just listen to those field recordings and choose 18 micro moments that I felt at the time of recording. I remember, you know, while you make these recordings, different things go through your ears and your head. And I remember being in these places and remarking to myself about the natural musicality that exists within the place. And I felt, okay, we've got this within nature, and then obviously we've got an abundance of this within a musician. So what happens when we put the two together and invite the two into a sort of dialogue space? Each of the 18 performers are people that I have either worked with or had conversations with that I felt kind of understand the fragile nature of these environments. So there's a huge element of trust that happens in these kinds of compositions. When I chose these tracks, each of them has this kind of unforeseeable element, which of course happens when you field record. And they also have this natural composed framework that I then enhance when I approached each of the performers. So they each have an aural part, and they have the aural score, which is the field recording. And they're basically free to negotiate the unique way they hear that place and the unique way they hear the relationship between the aural score and the aural part.
My name is Laurie Lixenberg. I was very happy to get this track because you know, that the monkey is traditionally like it's the trickster character. I'm very interested in comedy. It's something that's featured a lot in my past. And so it felt that this really suited my personality. And I've been going through this process of transcribing birdsong. I'm making a kind of manual of singing, which is lighthearted in a way, but so I transcribe birdsong and make them into vocal exercises. time. I listened over and over again, and I practiced, and I did different versions. I recorded different versions, and I sort of refined the performance until I came up with one that, it took me quite a long time, actually. I really wanted it to represent what I was hearing and my response to it. Make my own work. I don't call it composition, I call it making things with sound. As a performer, I specialise in the now, and I'm very interested in composers that are pushing boundaries and experimenting and really trying to explore different aspects of musicality and creation. What I really loved was the way of transmitting a score, because even now it feels like the written score on five staves reigns supreme. And I kind of think, come on guys, it's the 21st century, it's like we're still on papyrus with quills or something. I was really intrigued by that as well.
I've gone through many, many different stages during lockdown. One was just sheer exhaustion. It's been a crazy 2 years. Luckily, there's still work. I'm very lucky because I work a lot outside of Ireland. And definitely, I think other countries are opening up maybe quicker than we are. But one thing we did manage to do was sort of started performing in a quartet, which two of the people are in the States and two are in Ireland. So we've been looking at a lot of platforms to improve this quartet's network performances. And that's really interesting because that's moving very quickly now. You can actually hear each other properly and you can actually create together. So that was a real eye-opener.
Karen Power there, and you heard also from Laurie Lixenberg. Human Nature is now available at composerkarenpower.bandcamp.com. Since the spring, environmentalist and writer Paddy Woodworth has been helping us assemble a shelf of essential nature writing, from Rachel Carson to Robert McFarlane. But so far we haven't added an observer of Ireland. That changes this time, as Paddy suggests we make space for a local on the naturalist bookshelf.
The Basque magic realist, Bernardo Echaga, once questioned whether those of us over 50 should continue trying to reduce that pile of unread books that stretches into the future and taunts many of us like a bad conscience. Instead, we should select the 100 books that have nourished us most during our lives so far and reread them, both playfully and thoughtfully, for the rest of our days. There is surely something to be said for this approach. To enter a well-stocked bookshop as a bookish teenager is an early lesson in mortality. A scan of the shelves tells you that you'll be dead long before you could read everything that might engage you. So why not embrace that fact a bit later in life and sink ever deeper into the pleasures and perhaps even the wisdom that certain inexhaustible books can give us and keep on giving? If I took Echaga's pledge, I know the two books at the top of my list because I already return to them so often. One is Peter Matheson's epic 900-page novel, Shadow Country. This is a riveting, archetypal tale of American capitalism's dark obsession with violence. It is set along the wilderness waterway in the western Everglades, atmospherically infused by Matheson's deep knowledge of the natural history of these teeming rivers of grass. I've read this book 3 times in 5 years. I'm still hungry for more. The other book on my list is set much closer to home and is much shorter, Michael Viney's A Year's Turning. This book distills many years observing nature in his sanctuary on the Mayo Coast into a single, delightful almanac. Viney always writes at the fertile ecotone between science and poetry. Readers of his inimitable column in Saturday's Irish Times know this well. And like that column, this book is given an extra dimension through his telling illustrations, as precise, spirited and lyrical as his prose. Animals are portrayed here as organic elements of the landscape in which their lives are enmeshed. And of course, that's exactly what they are. This book ranges very widely. There is a moving and funny account of his tentative efforts as a townie raised in England to mesh with his slightly baffled Mayo neighbours through the ritual of mehel, collective farm labour. His wry observations of their verbal pyrotechnics and his own floundering attempts to join in prompts a reflection on the etymology of crack, which, he concludes, wittily and correctly, is an Irish word that never was. His struggle to lead a self-sufficient rural life in an unforgiving landscape, alongside his capable and beloved wife Ethna, gets ample self-deprecating space. But the vertebrae of the book are formed from the vibrant seasonal parade of plants, animals and weather systems that flow in and out of Viney's keenly observant and appreciative view from month to month. For several years after reading the whole book, I did devote a little time each month to rereading the appropriate chapter for the time of year. And they always read freshly. Often they would bring my attention to some aspect of nature I had not previously noticed. And my next reading was often happily enriched by my encounters with a particular bird or flower or snail that he had mentioned in the meantime. For the month that's in it, he has a wonderful passage evoking September's colossal and coppery harvest moon and how it stirs great oscillations in the sea. And he then traces their emergence as a surging flood that sweeps inland from the strand, erasing the lines of otter runs and filling the rabbit holes and the hollows of summer larks. The flood reaches up the river and joins the lakes in a vast and alien congregation of silver water. Finally, the rising water finds swans at the furthest corner of the reeds and carries them further still, bearing them like emblems across the drowned pastures. The next day, he walks the cleaned and rejuvenated strand in something of an autumn ritual. Detailed observation of natural phenomena lead him back again and again to challenging interpretations of the natural world by scientists like Stephen Jay Gould, E.O. Wilson, and Richard Dawkins, and to the insistent existential questions these interpretations raise. "It did not occur to me," he writes, "when I chose to live closer to nature, that natural history and biology would come to be so much of the fabric of my thought, and that I would end up exploring my own existence along with the rest of creation." That Viney has done both for so long and so eloquently is a gift that very many Irish people and people beyond this country cherish every time they read him.
Paddy Woodworth there with the latest addition to the Naturalist's Bookshelf. If you'd like to hear about all the previous books, check out our playlist on Spotify. And finally this weekly, the latest from Maurice Gohan. One of the possible upsides of the COVID winter ahead of us, like the COVID summer behind us, is that the pauses on new content production have given us time to consume some classics and consume them without fear of missing out on whatever new series gets touted as The New Wire, The New Watchmen, or indeed, in the case of writer and comedian Maurice Gohan, The New Sopranos. Because, as Maurice's careful research has discovered, The New Sopranos is in fact The Old Sopranos.
I'm rewatching The Sopranos at the moment. It's some show. Each episode is like a little movie. And I'm not alone. Apparently everyone and their mother has been watching The Sopranos over the past few months. Viewership went up 179% in lockdown. And I get it. It's well written, it's well produced, and it gives us a glimpse into a crazy world we can't really fathom actually existing. Tony Soprano is an interesting guy because he does terrible, awful stuff, but we root for him. He's the anti-hero hero. He kills people, but is also in therapy. Our brains just explode with that sort of well-roundedness. What is it about morally and ethically bad lead characters that make us root for them? It doesn't happen in real life. But in TV and film, it's different. Maybe because if someone is upfront bad, all you can find if you search is good. If you're a mob leader, every surprising twist is a good one. Or maybe it's just that we're told he's the good guy because he's the main character. In the same way Lolita had me thinking Hubbard Hubbard was an alright guy for a hot minute, until I put some thought into it and could see, oh wait, no, paedophile, definitely paedophile. I first watched the series in December 2012, when I finished my job in Chicago but had an extra month there, so I watched 4 episodes a day. I got immersed in it. I don't watch TV shows much because I get obsessed. I want to be whatever I'm watching. While I watched Holby City, I wanted to be a doctor. Get her blood, stat! I'd scream at my mum as she cut the spuds. When I watched Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, I wanted to be a rich middle-aged woman. So, when I watched The Sopranos, I wanted to be in the mob. I know I wouldn't last in the mob, though. I know, deep down, that they'd never accept me. For one, you can't be a rat. In The Sopranos, they kill the guys who rat them out to the FBI. I would have struggled with that. As a kid, I was a big-time snitch. My cousins hated me. Just be cool, Maurice. And I could never be cool. I'd catch my cousins smoking, and they'd be like, don't tell our mums. And I'd be like, I'm sorry, but that's exactly what I'm gonna do.
Everybody, come on!
They also eat a lot of processed meat in The Sopranos.
Bolognese has meat, obviously. The marinara doesn't. And Barb will be here with the chicken parm and the veal pizza.
Tony's always chowing down on some salami. I couldn't hack that. Would remind me too much of Billy Roll. Remember Billy Roll? That weird circular pink processed meat that had a smiley face on it? Whose genius idea in marketing was that? How'd we get kids to eat more of our product? Put a smiling face on it. Kids love smiling. And then some bold kids in school would always eat out the eyes and wear the Billy Roll on their face, run around chasing everyone with their deformed mask. I still have nightmares about Billy Roll. I also can't eat ham, another meat staple with the boys, because it was my dog Bingo's favourite food. He's now deceased, but he lived to be 18 years with only 3 legs, so he had a good life, but he really loved ham. So I can't eat it, it reminds me too much of him. For the same reason, I also can't hump the leg of strangers or pee on trees. The memories are too painful. And finally, I think the biggest reason I couldn't be in the mob, bigger than me being a woman or not wanting to murder anyone, is that I don't like to hug. These men love to hug.
Big galoot! How are you?
Every time they meet, there's a hug. I've only seen hugging on that level when I was a 15-year-old girl. It used to drive my mother nuts when she'd collect me and watch me saying goodbye to my friends. You're not going off to war. You'll see them tomorrow. Why the big dramatic goodbye? But I grew out of that, and now I hate to touch another person in any sort of greeting. So the mob isn't for me. But Holby City is still on the cards.
Maurice Gohan there, despite everything, refusing a certain offer. And bringing to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back next Saturday at 6:30 p.m. and in podcast form whenever you feel like it. Follow us on Spotify for all our latest and previous pods. Till next time, bye now.